Good morning and welcome to Trending Now with Josh Arnold. I'm Rick Moore, along with our producer and engineer, Bill Proposky. And, of course, Josh is our co-host. We try to do this every Friday morning, at least as often as we can.
Yeah.
You know, however the wind blows and stuff like that, if the technology is working and, you know, everything's plugged in. Anyway, what do we got lined up for today, young man?
Paul Crowley, the executive director of the Greater Lynn Senior Service, is our first guest. Second guest up is Amanda Orlando Kesterson, who's the chairwoman of the Gloucester Republican City Committee, going to talk about presidential politics. And then third guest is the new harbor master in Gloucester, Captain Thomas Cimitaro, going to tell us about his career and taking over as the new harbor master for Gloucester.
Sounds good. All right, all that coming right up.
The Gloucester House Restaurant at historic Seven Seas Wharf, 63 Rogers Street, Gloucester. This is owner Lenny Linquata.
We provide service and product better than anybody else. It comes directly from our boats right to your plate. We have fishermen that work great for us. We are wholesalers that we buy what we want to serve to our customers, and we put the rest of it right out in the market.
The Gloucester House Restaurant. Visit thegloucesterhouse.com.
This is the freshest seafood you can get from our boats to your plate.
People come in, take a seat, you're really in for a treat at Sylvan Street. A great place to eat and drink and meet with family and friends at Sylvan Street. We'll treat you right, day or night, satisfy your appetite. Eat, drink, and chill at the Sylvan Street Grill.
Catch a game with friends, meet for lunch, cocktails after work, or a romantic dinner for two. Whatever you plan to do it at Sylvan Street Grill in Peabody and Salisbury. See you at Sylvan Street.
Eat, drink, and chill at the Sylvan Street Grill.
Welcome back to Trending Now with Josh Arnold, and our first guest is Paul Crowley. Paul, welcome to the program.
Hi, Josh. How are you today?
Good.
So
we usually start out, tell us a little bit about yourself, your bio and your background and so forth, and then we can get into some other questions.
Okay, sure. So I'm a local Lynn guy, born and raised here in Lynn. I've been here all my life, and I am currently the executive director of Greater Lynn Senior Services, a nonprofit agency in housed in Lynn that services 3,000 people a day for home care services, as well as 3,000 people a day. My background is I'm an accountant by trade. Trained at Northeastern University, Price Waterhouse, got into the investment business turned into the management business turned into the planning business, and then lo and behold, I find myself the ED of Greater Lynn Senior Services for the past 7 years. Kind of a unique way of getting there, but here I am nonetheless.
Great. Now, you spent some time as a member of the Lynn City Council. Tell us about that and what some of the things were going on then and now.
Yeah, so back in, 2005, as a lot of people can probably attest to in the audience, you have a run-in with the city or your town over a certain matter that affects you and or your family, and you get upset about it, and you decide that if anything's ever going to change, you got to do something about it. That happened to my family and I back in 2005, and as a result, I made a decision to run for the city council. It was an at-large position, which is a citywide seat. So I ran in 2005 on a kind of a platform of change, and got elected. Back then, I was kind of a dark horse candidate in that I was not very well known in the city, but nevertheless, I came in second, and they picked the top four, so I served on the city council for 6 years, and during that time, I worked really hard to understand what was going on in the city, and tried to take some of the talents that I had and bring them to bear on change in the city, and I had some success with that. And I also created a lot of challenges, because a lot of people that prefer the status quo, and I represented change, and it was always difficult. So anyway, that's
change is always difficult in any organization, but in particular the public sector.
Yes.
Too many people have a vested interest in something, want to just keep the party going and not change with the times. It's always
right.
Difficult.
Yeah, in the public sector, it is very clear. I mean, I think you can, I don't want to get too far afield here, but you can just see with the tone of the current election, the presidential election, when you sort through all of the back and forth between the two parties in terms of, you know, how bad that one is and how bad the other one is, you really get down to it's really do we want to go the direction that it's currently going, which is kind of more of a open borders globalist approach, or do you want to be more nationalistic and a sovereign entity and those kinds of things? It is a status quo versus change kind of election, and it's very similar in that regard.
Great. So you've been involved with the executive director of Greater Lynn Senior Services. Tell us about that organization and the work it does.
Sure. It's an extraordinary organization. In fact, last night we had our 40th anniversary celebration. We have been a nonprofit in the health and human services space for 40 years. We've been doing it for quite some time. As you can imagine, we started back in 1976, and we had about 25 employees supporting the needs of about 200 elders in the community. Today we have close to 700 employees, and we're supporting the needs of about 6,000 people. So you can see how, much we've grown over those years. It's an extraordinary organization in many respects.
And it's not just people in Lynn, it's people up and down the North Shore, is that right?
Yeah, so each there are 26 aging services access points statewide, and that is what Bliss is, and they're designations from the Massachusetts Secretary of Elder Affairs. We all have our own territory. So while we are Lynn predominantly, we are Greater Lynn in reality, and that includes Nahant, Swampscott, Lynnfield, and Saugus. I think to your point about the North Shore, we, through our affiliation with the Greater North Shore Link, we are also connected with another 14 cities and towns north of our catchment area, going all the way up to Gloucester, and that includes North Shore Elder Services and Senior Care, which are two other ASAPs just like us.
Now, when I'm out riding around doing things, and I see GLIS vehicles seeming like everywhere, a big piece of what you do is your transportation fleet, and tell us a little bit about that if you can.
Sure. So the you're right. People say that all the time. They always see our vans. You know, we have the paratransit vehicles out there. And for the listening audience, we are, a transportation provider, but we also are the North a vendor for the MBTA with respect to the paratransit ride service. So between what we do separate and apart from the ride and the ride, we're doing about 3,000 trips a day. And we cover 26 cities and towns all over the North Shore, including Boston. And last night I was speaking about this at the 40th celebration, and it's important to note that back in 1991 we had 1988 the executive director at the time, Vince Liqui, decided that transportation was a critical part of helping people to remain active and living in the community and all that kind of stuff. And so he felt transportation was an important thing, so he got into the transportation business. In 1991, there were 9 vehicles with 8 part-time drivers. And today we have 306 vehicles and 400 drivers. And, as I said earlier, we provide transportation for upwards of 3,000 people a day.
That's great. And that's transportation, like, to medical appointments, to all kinds of things?
Medical appointments. So if you look at the GLIS side of the business, which is, the non-MBTA stuff, we are providing people with medical trips, as you said. We help people get to and from senior centers, adult day programs. We get people to work, people who need paratransit services and so forth. Additionally, we, as I said earlier, we're part of the paratransit network of the MBTA, and so that is really an extension of the fixed route system.
Okay.
And the fixed route system is the, the buses and the commuter rail and all, and the subways and all that kind of stuff. So to help people who can't easily access the fixed route system, the paratransit system was created. And if somebody needs a ride and is eligible for the ride through the MBTA, we'll give them a ride pretty much anywhere they need to go, as long as it's in our, in the MBTA's catchment area, which runs from the north, where we cover, all the way down to the south shore and out almost, so just before you get to Metro West Framingham type area. So so for the ride, we're really talking about, somebody wants to go to the mall to return a gift. Somebody wants to go get their hair done. Somebody wants to go visit a relative. Somebody wants to go to the bar down the street. You can't get there on their own. MBTA service is available for that if they're eligible.
Great. Now, you deal with senior people, but you also do work with the people with disabilities as well. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, the way we like to describe it is all ages and all abilities. And yes, we do that. Certainly in the in our role as a transportation provider for people who have a hard time getting around, that can be people who are limited in mobility, whether it's due to age or disability. It doesn't, there's no distinction there. It's just if you need the service, we provide it. And but we also, and I think it's a good point. I'm glad you brought it up, Josh, and that is that we have a, as an aging service access plan, which I described earlier, we service a population that is 60 years of age and older. And we are, certainly doing that, and we do that each and every day, and we love the work that we do. But with a shifting environment and, extraordinary costs associated with health care and so forth, the work that we do is expanding outside of that 60 and over population, and kind of more from a population health perspective is, so now the distinction is not how old are you, it is what are your needs. And if your needs are consistent with somebody who could use supports and help in the home, then we provide it. So that means now we're talking with people who are certainly under 60, under 50, even under 40. We really run the gamut now in terms of the services that we provide.
And what kind of services could those include for people that are in the 40, 50, 60 range who have a range of physical or mental challenges?
Yeah, so in speaking to that population, a population that is younger, clearly there are less physical limitations, and there are more behavioral health and mental health challenges associated with this population. And we certainly recognize that and have a kind of a have recognized that it requires a different skill set and so forth, and we've actually adapted our approach to a more person-centered approach, where we're really focusing on not providing for a consumer, but giving them the tools to provide for themselves. And so that's where the shift has occurred. And, you know, for somebody who has a behavioral health issue, for example, substance use disorder, you know, many times the challenges that they face each and every day can be mitigated if they're if they have the tools to address it. And what we try to do is give them those tools, and hopefully that will lead to less episodic and crisis type actions that lead to, you know, emergency room visits, crisis intervention, all that kind of stuff. And that's kind of the way we focus on things. And that's, by the way, that is something that really extends to our relationship with the Greater North Shore Link, which is, you know, a much broader audience. Covers 19 cities and towns, as I mentioned earlier, but also involves all people of all ages and all abilities. So it's a much bigger than Greater Lynn Senior Services.
Which was really a perfect segue into, I was going to ask you, what you're president of the board of the Greater North Shore Link. Tell us about your role there and a little bit more about the organization, if you can.
Sure. Okay, so the Greater North Shore Link is a legally formed nonprofit corporation that was founded by essentially four leadership members from the North Shore that represented the Aging and Disabilities Resource Consortium, and that is us, Greater Lynn Senior Services, North Shore Elder Services, immediately to our north, and then up in Gloucester, up your way, there's senior care, and then the Independent Living Center of the Greater North Shore and Cape Ann out of Salem is also part of that group. So they represent the disability side of things, and our three agencies represent the, you know, the 60 and over population. And so we've been loosely formed since, I don't know, back in 2003 or four, but 3 years ago we incorporated. We have a budget. In fact, I think you know the executive director.
Yes.
Teresa Gouveia-Arnold is executive director. She manages the affairs every day. And my role in all of that is one of governance. I, as the president, and the other board members, you know, get updated regularly on the great work that Terry is doing to develop a community organization that has access and connection to all of the key community resources, and also connections to all of the people that might be interested or in need of the services that we provide, to create a no wrong door environment. And so that's what Terry does, and my job in that regard is to stay out of her way and let her do her job.
That's great.
Yep.
We've got about a minute left. Any final thoughts you'd like to share with us?
Sure. So one of the important things that I think is necessary for people to understand with the great challenges that we face in not only across the United States, but specifically here in Commonwealth of Massachusetts, where we spend 40% of our budget on health and human services, is that the costs are, you know, certainly unsustainable, the way they're growing and so forth. And, you know, kind of a new approach to addressing these cost overruns is to rethink the way we approach healthcare. You know, there's a triple aim that's up there. It's we want to improve health, we want to improve healthcare, and we want to lower costs. And the main way to do that, in my view, and I think in the view of a lot of people, is to integrate the work that we do in the community, which is LTSS, long-term service and supports coordination, with the people that are handling the medical health issues, you know, doctors and hospitals and the like. The work that we're doing together needs to be more adequately integrated so that the things that are happening in the community. By the way, it's also always important to recognize that this is a theme that you'll hear constantly in our world, and it's that health happens in the community. People don't go to the doctor and then get sick. They're sick and then go to the doctor. So what we're looking to do is focus on the individual in the community and trying to understand what is causing them their challenges and help them to sort through it so that those challenges will be lessened and reduced in number. And that's, you know, that's what this is all about. I think it's really important for everybody to understand that, and if people recognize the value of the community and what agencies like Greater Lynn Senior Services and Greater North Shore Link do on each and every day with relationship building in the community, you'll see how much value what we do brings to the health equation.
Great. Well, I want to thank you for being a guest and taking some time out of your busy day and being a guest here on Trending Now with Josh Arnold.
It was my pleasure, Josh, and thanks for interviewing me. I really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Paul. Take care now.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Score early and often this fall with a low-rate residential loan from the Institution for Savings. The Institution for Savings has fantastic rates, low or no fees, great service, and prompt turnaround. Plus, we service our mortgages in-house, so help is always a local phone call away. For more information or to apply online 24/7, visit institutionforsavingsloans.com or call us at 978-462-2344. Institution for Savings, member FDIC and DIF, equal housing lender.
Hi, folks. This is Gerard Moynihan of Moynihan Lumber. If you're thinking of replacing the windows in your home, you should look at the Anderson Woodwright double-hung insert window, which comes with rich wood interiors in oak, pine, or maple. Quite simply, Anderson is the most trusted window in America. That's why we've been selling them for 57 years. Please see the Anderson Woodwright windows on display at any of our three locations in North Reading, Beverly, and Plaistow, New Hampshire, or at MoynihanLumber.com.
Moynihan Lumber, we measure up.
Hi, folks, this is Gerard Moynihan, and today I'd like to speak to you about the North Shore Student Athlete Program. Sponsored by Moynihan Lumber in conjunction with the Salem News, the Daily Item, the New Report Daily News, and the Gloucester Times. The program, now in its 24th year, celebrates high school students who excel not just on the playing field, but in the classroom as well. Male and female winners are chosen each month. All student athletes must be nominated by their coaches. Nominations for the program are made via email to nsstudentathlete@gmail.com. Youngsters who are nominated must have a B average or better. Monthly winners are then eligible to be selected as Student Athletes of the Year. Yearly winners and their families are recognized at a luncheon at the Salem Country Club held in early June. Please remember, all youngsters playing a varsity sport at any high school on the North Shore, public, private, or parochial, are eligible.
Moynihan Lumber, we measure up.
Welcome back to Trending Now with Josh Arnold. Our next guest is Amanda Orlando Kesserson, chairwoman of the Gloucester Republican City Committee. Amanda, welcome back to the program.
Thanks, Josh. Thanks for having me on.
Well, we wanted to do another round and talk about the presidential election, and lots happened since we last spoke. You want to weigh in on some of the happenings and what your perspective of all that is?
Sure. It's been a busy week in politics. Well, I think obviously you can't talk about recent events without talking about the infamous audio of Donald Trump talking about women and how that sort of exploded. We should talk about the WikiLeaks email exposure of the Clinton campaign. I think that that's a big issue. And, of course, there was the debate on Sunday night. So there's a lot of issues. I can weigh in on all of them, you know,
sure.
In some respect.
What is start with, obviously, the Trump tape. What's your take on it and its relevance and its timing?
Okay, well, I think that my take on it is that it's very crude language and nobody likes to hear it. It was a long time ago. and he was speaking in private. And I think most voters, if they're really honest with themselves, know that we've all said things in private that we really hope people don't hear someday. And unfortunately, the fact that it gets exposed during a presidential campaign, it does cast a dark cloud sometimes on someone's, you know, personality and how they view life, which, of course, the Clinton campaign knew. The trouble that Hillary Clinton has in capitalizing on the tape is that it opens up the discussion of sexual, you know, issues that, let's face it, there's no president in history that's been more tied in with issues regarding his sex life than Bill Clinton. So when you take the leap, and I think it was a leap for her, I think when she decided, okay, this is the path we're going to go, we really need to expose this, this is going to help me, she's also opening herself up to an awful lot of scrutiny. And the fact is that most fair-minded people look at it and say, well, wait a minute, we had a president sitting in the White House who was having very public affairs, and, you know, many of us thought, well, leave the guy alone, that's his private life, it doesn't have any bearing on how he performs the duties as president. And you can't then, you know, have that standard for Bill Clinton and then apply a different one for Donald Trump. So, you know, I think, does it help her in the short term? It probably gives her a little bump, particularly amongst women. But I think it's also a month before the election that it came out, and something like that, you know, it goes away after a while. People, it loses its effectiveness on the audience, and so, you know, I question the timing of it. I actually don't think, if she really wanted it to help her and to maximize the help, I think she probably should have released it closer to the election. I think by the time the election rolls around, it'll be a long dead issue, and there'll have been a lot more that has come up since. So,
and it's your sense then that, although it was the Washington Post that broke the story and released the video and the audio tapes, that this was the underpinnings of the Clinton campaign.
Yeah, well, there's some rumblings that Billy Bush, who was the interviewer who Donald Trump was talking to, was actually paid to release that. And, you know, I'm fairly certain that the Clinton campaign, while I have no proof that they were the ones actually behind finding it, they certainly knew it was coming out. It wasn't a surprise to her. You know, they were clearly tipped off and ready for it. They released it the Friday. It was released the Friday before the second debate. So it was the news cycle all day Friday, all day Saturday, all day Sunday leading up to the debate. The Clinton campaign was surely told about it, if they weren't directly involved in it. So,
I mean, yeah, within 48 hours of the story breaking, there were advertisements drawing that into it being used in Senate and congressional races around the country.
Exactly. I mean, it was coordinated, and there's just no way that the Clinton campaign did not have its tentacles in that story, and in how it broke and being ready for it. And I'm pretty sure that whoever had that information sat on it until the Clinton campaign said, okay, release it. And I actually think it, you know, unfortunately, what people view as, oh, this is the beginning of the end of Donald Trump with this tape, I actually don't see it that way, because my feeling is, if Hillary Clinton was sitting as pretty as the media would have you believe in this election, she wouldn't have had to release that tape. She wouldn't have wanted the distraction. She would have wanted people focusing on her message. She would have wanted people focusing on how far ahead she was and how well she was doing in the polls. And that's not at all what's happening. What's happening now is they're just dredging up, you know, dirt upon dirt upon dirt, most of which isn't even true, just to distract from the fact that she's actually not doing as well as she should be doing 3 weeks before the election.
So, segue over to the debate. When we spoke last time, when you were on the show before, I had said, gee, it looked to me like he had the opportunity to, there were times when he had the opportunity to fire back at Secretary Clinton and chose not to. And you know, that wasn't just my observation. Obviously, that was an observation by Trump supporters and analysts and broadcasters around the country, because in the second interview, he closed ranks and did just that. Tell us about how that played out in your mind and how you thought the debate went.
Well, so I agree with you. I think the first debate, I'm sure he was advised, you know, be moderate, be temperate, don't fly off the handle, don't be too aggressive. People don't like that. And I understand why someone would advise him that way, but I actually think it hurt him in the first debate. He wasn't Donald Trump. And so in the second debate, and he really had no choice given this explosive story that came out two days before the debate, he had to come out swinging. And he had to take on not just his opponent, but the media, because the media is such a huge part of this election. I mean, I think in general the media slants heavily to the left in presidential elections, but I've never seen it like this. So when he came into the debate, he really came out swinging, and he did not hold back, and I thought it worked to his advantage, especially towards the beginning of the debate. I think he did really, really well. He was right on it. He, you know, pushed back against when Hillary Clinton was, you know, waxing about things that made no sense or had a non-answer. He called her on it. And he also called the moderators on their clear bias, because
there was a point where
the audience.
There was a point where on a defense issue, one of the moderators actually, instead of saying, "Well, I thank you for your opinion," began debating with Trump himself.
Exactly. And I think Trump did a really good job of saying, you know, and he said it a couple of times during the debate, "Who am I debating with?" You know, essentially that was his message. "Who am I debating with here?" And it's 3-on-1.
Yeah.
This is 3-on-1. I mean, you had two moderators arguing with him, virtually not challenging Hillary Clinton at all on her answers and or non-answers. And so, you know, he's very good about being willing to put himself out there and saying, "This is the reality of what is happening right now. You're all in the tank. You've clearly picked a side. This is not a fair debate, and I don't mind standing here and answering your questions, but the audience should know what's really going on, and it should be pointed out." And I thought he did that very well in the second debate.
Well, I've told a story about Steve McQueen in public relations circles about him getting the role on the Magnificent Seven, and I won't go there per se, but Steve McQueen, as an actor, had a reputation for stealing people's camera shots, and I bring that up only because when I watched the debate, that's what I thought Trump was doing. I thought he was getting in. I mean, because it was an open meeting type forum, they could move around and address different parts of the audience. It looked to me like, although he paced, you know, during the debate, he was kind of blending in to be part of the camera shot, so it wouldn't be like in the first debate that the person on one side and person on the other side of the screen.
Right.
Is that
right,
the way you saw it? And I ask you that.
I definitely saw that
because after the debate, Howard Dean, who after the previous debate thought Donald Trump's sniffles were cocaine related, began to suggest that this was an example of predatory behavior and he was stalking Hillary.
Right. Well, I think that's ridiculous on both counts, the cocaine and the stalking. I think mostly he was hyped up and he was high energy and he was pacing, and he was pacing while she was speaking, and because it was not like a podium,
yeah,
he was sort of pacing around her. And I think, you know, obviously, I don't think it was a coordinated effort to steal her camera shots, and I certainly don't think he was trying to stalk her. It is an intimidation tactic sometimes. I mean, if you're pacing around while someone's answering, she would have to then be more focused,
yeah,
to not be distracted by him. But I didn't. When I watched it, I did not get the feeling that it was any sort of coordinated,
yeah,
you know, attack on her. I really thought he was just so ready for the debate that he had all this energy that he was trying to contain so that he didn't actually go over the top, but just was aggressive enough. So that's how I took it.
How did you rate the debate? Who won it, if anybody won it?
I thought Trump won it, merely by coming out of it with some of the best one-liners that were memorable. I thought Hillary won the first one, and I credited the first one too. She was incredibly prepared in the first one, and he was not as prepared and was not himself in the second one, because he was able to put her on the defensive more. I thought he did a very good job, and I would call him the winner of the second debate.
We talked about the WikiLeaks, and you know, I noticed that before the debate, former Massachusetts Governor Bill Weld, who used to be work with Hillary in the federal justice system, I believe, and was saying there's more to the WikiLeaks than people are taking a look at, that people are processing. But I have to wonder, did the revelations of the Washington, in your view at least, did the revelations of the Washington Post become the trump card that put the WikiLeaks stuff way back of the list in terms of people's interest?
Yes, because the Trump audio video is much more salacious, and so it's more interesting to the viewer. Plus, the media doesn't really want to talk about Hillary's emails. They don't find it as fun, and they're certainly not going to promote negative things about Hillary. So they're playing the audio over and over and over again, and so it is taking it's taking all the steam out of what, as far as who's more qualified to be president. The WikiLeaks stuff is incredibly powerful, and anybody who really wants to know about how this person will govern should be reading those emails.
Well, I guess
it tells you a lot about Hillary Clinton and her campaign and their philosophy, and that's about being president. You know, what Donald Trump said about a woman 12 years ago has so little impact on his abilities and his, you know, his philosophy of being president. It has so little to do with it. But what Hillary is saying as she's running her campaign and the things that they're doing and the messaging that they're putting out there, that has a lot to do with how she's going to be president.
Well, I guess one of the questions that I ponder here is, you have on the one hand an audio tape of Donald Trump talking, in which he, theoretically at least, was of the belief that that wasn't something that was going to be aired or open to the public.
Right.
You have Hillary Clinton's former campaign manager's emails that were hacked by someone and then released to the public, i.e. the WikiLeaks. To allow the public to see, hear, watch stuff that was largely intended to not be in the public domain.
Right.
What does that say about the media or the public at large in their zest or quest to for data in a instant information age? Have the tables all been turned? Is there nothing that's sacred anymore, or is there anything that, you know, How has this changed the political climate going forward in terms of what people will say or not say, or how things will be covered?
Well, you know, I work in a law firm, and one of the things that we say is write every email as if it will someday be read in a deposition.
Yep.
Because the reality is, when you put something in writing in our world, it's in writing.
Yeah.
And it's going to be read. It could be read someday. What you say to somebody, generally speaking, should be at least private, and Donald Trump was certainly speaking to somebody, got caught in a hot mic, but he was speaking to somebody. He didn't, you know, put it down. But either way, you're right, they're breaking into what is essentially private correspondence, and they're exposing it. Now, the media, they're selective in their outrage about a politician's private thoughts and private actions. I mean, they vilify some for your private thoughts, and they don't vilify others. But we don't own the president of the United States. I mean, we elect him, and he works for us as his constituents or her constituents. And but they do have a life. They're people. And right now we have, I mean, I think Donald Trump's 69 years old, and Hillary's late 60s as well. They've lived a long life. They've had a lot of interactions with people and relationships with people, good, bad, or indifferent. And so to expose all of them and put them out publicly and let the public judge their abilities as president, to some extent, is not fair. On the other hand, they are public figures, and they're running for the highest office in the land, and they need to own whatever their behavior has been to the public and tell them how they're going to be when they're working for the public in the White House. So it's a tough one. I mean, I think the media, they're hungry. You know, certainly we all know presidents historically have had extremely steamy personal lives that the media did not expose. I mean, JFK is one of them, right? He lived a very active life, but he was also president of the United States, and the public didn't know about any of it until much later.
You'd be surprised if you go through the history of the American presidency, how many presidents did have similar situations.
Absolutely, absolutely, which is why I think the outrage over Trump's comments is so disingenuous. It's just, I mean, anybody who doesn't sit there and sit back and say, wait a minute, you know, a group of guys at a bachelor party, or even a group of women out to dinner having a couple drinks, people say off-color things all the time. They certainly talk about members of the opposite sex in some very crass ways at some points. And, you know, I think if we all had that exposed, we'd all be very embarrassed by at one point in our life saying something that we would prefer people not to know when we were with friends. So, you know, do I like it? No. Do I like hearing it? No. Do I think the language is crude and, you know, crass? Absolutely. Do I think it means he can't be a good president? No. I think he can be a very good president.
We got maybe a minute left, and I have to go to our next guest. But how much is this a game changer in terms of how much does the Trump campaign have to do damage control to come back from this, and how much does that take them away from the message that they were trying to generate to begin with in this short window of time?
He's got to pivot back very quickly to the economy and national security, because that's where he's strong and that's where she's weak. And he apologized for it, which was the right thing to do. He came right out of the gate and did that. He apologized at the debate. And then I think the story dies now, or should die, because he should pivot back. The Trump campaign needs to pivot back. Now, he's actually being helped by the fact that there's so much outrage over it, because Republicans are jumping ship and Democrats are all outraged. And so he's saying, hey, here I am again, not a party guy, not somebody who's supported by the parties. I'm an independent voice coming to Washington, and they're all afraid. And that's actually, that resonates with voters. So in some ways, this actually can help him if he uses it correctly. So I think hopefully this week we'll see him pivot back to the issues. There's one more debate on the 19th. And I think if, as long as Trump stays on message and stops chasing all the stories that are coming out at him and just kind of shrugs his shoulders and says, this is ridiculous, we need to be talking about the issues and who's best to lead the country, then he can move on from it very effectively leading up to the election.
Great. Well, thank you for being a guest again on Trending Now with Josh Arnold. And we'll have you back again either next week or in 2 weeks to probably next week to follow up on the last debate.
Great, Josh. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Amanda. Great.
All right.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Looking for a reliable place to produce your team's uniforms or your business's corporate apparel? Then Sakhisian Sportswear is the place for you. Conveniently located on Route 1 South in Peabody, Mass., Sakhisian Sportswear handles all aspects of your needs, from price quoting to providing visual proofs to production completion. Visit our website, SakhisianSports.com, to view our monthly specials, vendor catalogs, and to request a quote. Remember, Sakhisian Sportswear is the place to go.
Gloria Food Store is still Beverly's number one deli, and no matter what New England weather is thrown at us, Gloria is open. With fresh bread delivered from Sunray Bakery every morning, Gloria can provide party platters, calzones, hot trays, cold trays, salad trays, and finger sandwiches for whatever you have planned. Call in your order at 978-922-3613, stop in at 268 Rantoul Street, or visit GloriaFoodStore.com.
The Gloucester House Restaurant at historic Seven Seas Wharf, 63 Rogers Street, Gloucester. This is owner Lenny Linquata.
We provide service and product better than anybody else. It comes directly from our boats right to your plate. We have fishermen that work great for us. We are wholesalers that we buy what we want to serve to our customers, and we put the rest of it right out in the market.
The Gloucester House Restaurant. Visit thegloucesterhouse.com.
This is the freshest seafood you can get from our boats to your plate.
Hi, folks. This is Gerard Moynihan of Moynihan Lumber. If you're thinking of replacing the windows in your home, you should look at the Anderson Woodwright double hung insert window, which comes with rich wood interiors in oak, pine, or maple. Quite simply, Anderson is the most trusted window in America. That's why we've been selling them for 57 years. Please see the Anderson Woodwright windows on display at any of our three locations in North Reading, Beverly, and Plaistow, New Hampshire, or at MoynihanLumber.com.
Moynihan Lumber, we measure up.
Welcome back to Trending Now with Josh Arnold. Our next guest is Captain Thomas Shimotaro, the harbor master from Gloucester. Tom, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Well, we usually start out, tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and we can get into and talk about some of what you're doing as the new harbor master.
I got appointed to this position back in late June, early July. I did 10 years active duty, U.S. Coast Guard. Was a boatswain mate, got out off of active duty as an E6, was stationed in North Carolina, Virginia, Gloucester, and Boston. Still active in reserves. I got a background, as well as a Coast Guard background and a commercial captain's background with anything from boat deliveries to on-the-water training, and graduate from the Maritime Law Enforcement Academy in Charleston, South Carolina. So I did a fair amount of maritime law enforcement on active duty, and now I'm here.
Great. What are some of the challenges that you face as the harbor master for Gloucester, and just kind of walk us through some of that?
Yeah, so, we get almost 60 miles of coastline here, and it's a very dynamic situation with the outer harbor, the inner harbor, the Anasquam River. So pretty much, one of the biggest challenges is having visibility on all of our area, with a limited number of, platforms and boats and a limited number of guys. It's hard to keep eyes on the whole picture here with everything going on. We have cruise ships coming to Gloucester now. We have a lot of transient, recreational boaters coming into Gloucester, as well as, maintaining, all of our transient moorings and making sure that the citizens that have private moorings are taken care of and wait lists are moving, and maintaining all of our commercial marinas that we have, and just making sure everything runs smooth, for everybody, visitors as well as people that live here.
Great. What are some of the things you do day in and day out as a harbor master?
Day-to-day operations, it varies. One day I could come into the office and I'm on a disabled vessel, case. The next day we're doing boat maintenance, working on transient moorings, working on some of the commercial marinas, as well as dealing with, the general public for permitting, 10A temporary flow permits, Chapter 91 licenses, working with conservation and the shellfish warden, for permitting. So the job changes pretty much every day.
In terms of working with the shellfish warden and other types of regulatory work, what typically does that involve?
So if you wanted to get like a permit to put a new dock in or a pier structure, myself and the shellfish warden and conservation will all meet up. The shellfish warden, talks about, the impact of shellfish that the pier or dock would have. Conservation is, making sure that it's conforming with boundary lines and so on, such. And coastal erosion, and myself, I'm there to, maintain Army Corps engineer standards for setbacks and people's property, as well as the channel or the harbor commissioner line if you're inside the harbor.
Okay. Am I right that you cannot, if you're a lobster person, you cannot do lobstering in the inner harbor?
Correct. Yeah, pretty much. If you drew a line from the old paint factory over to Cape Pond Ice, it's the inner harbor area, which is a city ordinance that's a no lobstering area.
Okay. And there, you know, the harbor community development plan and the harbor development plan talk about the potential for dredging the harbor. Do you see that happening anytime soon? And what are some of the issues that come up when you take on something like that?
Well, we are currently working with the Army Corps and some congressmen, you know, at the congressional level to get funding to not dredge the inner harbor or the outer harbor right now, but it's to dredge the Anasquam River because that's what's in, you know, the most need. We just recently got approved for a nearshore disposal of the material, so that's huge for, you know, for the environmental portion of it, that any material that is dredged out of the Anasquam River has been deemed nearshore disposable, which means they could just take out the sand from A and bring it out to Essex Bay, which is, would be B, and get rid of it. So you have a lot of environmental, potential complications. And obviously funding, money, it all comes down to money in the end. Who's going to pay? Because it's a big project. It costs millions of dollars to get the Anasquam River dredged. But we'd really like to see it dredged for, you know, for the commercial standpoint, that commercial boats will be able to use it more regularly and not be so tidal dependent, as well as recreational boats, and for the need for the Coast Guard to be able to transit the Anasquam River safely during lower tidal ranges to get to Essex Bay for search and rescue response.
You go, you drive over the Apiat Andrew Bridge at low tide, and you can see the sandbars. I mean, if you're in on Wheeler's Point, you can walk over to Wingershete Beach on a lot of days at the right time.
Absolutely.
So that might so.
That's a problem. You know, it's a big problem. It's a problem for a safety standpoint. It's a problem for a commercial standpoint. It's a problem for a recreational.
How much time? When it's low tide, if someone's in distress at the water end, or the ocean end, the far end of the far north end of the Anasquam River,
like Essex Bay side, yeah.
What if you can't get an emergency boat up there to go around the point, if you will? What's the time differential on that?
Well, for us, we can pretty much get a boat through there at any tide now. But if the Coast Guard needed to respond to a major, you know, incident, a big fishing boat sinking, boat fire, something like that,
they're going to send a helicopter.
47-footer through there, they got to go around 16 miles out and around. So you're talking an hour, you know, hour and a half difference.
Yeah.
You know, so it's a big deal, you know. And, and when you have a maritime emergency like that, you don't have that kind
you
of...
You don't have an hour and a half. Yeah.
Absolutely not.
So what... what are some of the other issues that you're dealing with? I know that moorings is a big issue. Is there there's a site, you know, people have to apply for a permit to renew theirs, but there's also a higher demand than there is supply. Do you see that balancing out at all? Or
you know, there definitely is more of a demand than there is supply. We only have so much area to put moorings in. There is room for improvement, absolutely, and we're working on ways to improve that. We're working to get the wait list moving, but the fact of the matter is, for some areas like Lobster Cove or Smith Cove, you know, there's 300 people on that waiting list. People typically never give their mooring up until they get older or you know, pass away or move.
Yeah.
So some of those areas are never, you know, it could take years and years and years, 20, 30 years before you get a mooring because people just don't turn them over. You know, there's no expiration date once you get one. But we're looking into, you know, reorganizing certain mooring fields to potentially add boats. But we do anticipate issuing more moorings and following up with revoking more moorings that aren't being used.
Okay.
So we've already started that process, and I would like to continue through that and to speed things up and kind of settle them out.
Now, I noticed the City Council had passed an ordinance not that long ago requiring all waterfront properties to have the pilings, that the pilings had to be inspected within a certain time cycle as to how, you know, structurally safe they are or et cetera. Does your office get involved in that at all?
We do a little bit. We have records of Chapter 91 permits, which are pile-driven permits for piers or or wharfs, if you will. We do get involved in it. Most of it's conservation. A lot of these businesses which are within the DPA or buildings that are within the DPA, the designated port area, are in a harbor pile management plan, which they are allowed to replace 50 piles per year, I believe, under pretty much an open access permit. So that really kind of cuts the red tape out of it, and going through all the channels of, you know, DEP and my office and CONCOM, and, you know, it's better. It's a better program. It gives the owners, you know, easier access to do maintenance, pretty much.
Okay. And so do you think that ordinance is going to create better safety of the waterfront, or just,
you know,
accelerate the repairs? Or,
you know, I'd like to think that it will. The waterfront is aging. You know, this is the oldest port in the country. We got some pretty old waterfront infrastructure here that is going to need some pretty serious attention over the next, you know, however many years. And I think that, you know, it's a step in the right direction.
Great. What are some of the, we got a few minutes left on the show. What are some of the other things that you're engaged in? You work with the Waterways Board.
Correct, yeah.
And what is your role there? And they, I guess, are there to support the efforts of the Harbor Master?
Yeah, you know, they're a policy advisory committee to the mayor. So it's a group of volunteers that decide, you know, we'll try to come up with policies and procedures for the harbor. And, bring those, the chairman will bring those policies that they would like to see changed, you know, in front of the mayor. And the mayor ultimately decides whether we're going to go through with them or not. It's like a partial oversight of what's the bigger picture is. You know,
sure.
You do a lot of work with grants and funding to try to help my office out. So we have a good relationship, and I'd like to, you know, maintain that.
Well, Bobby Alves was telling me what a great guy you are, and how progressive you are, and all the work that you've got ahead of you, and how much better things are going to be now that you're on board.
Well, I hope so. You know, I really appreciate that. We've been getting really good feedback. We've changed a lot of stuff already. We're not even 10% of the way through, you know, the overall picture here. You know, everything takes time, and if you do it right the first time, we won't have to do it again. So that's the goal.
And you guys got a grant recently, I think, to the help through the EPA or through one of the regulatory agencies that helps clean or dispense of waste from boats. Or did I get that right?
Yes. Yeah. Well, what it is a grant through called the Clean Vessel Act,
yeah.
And it's to make sure that people aren't pumping sewage from their boats into the harbor. And, you know, to try to prevent some of that from happening, they've come, you know, the federal government has issued out to the state, and the state issues out to local municipalities and some private businesses like Cape Ann Marina to have a pump-out boat, which we've had for a few years down here that the Harbor Master's Office has had. And we can go out and pump-out boats and dispose of it properly through shoreside pump-outs, but we just recently got a pretty big grant. As most people know, that they're, you know, we have a big project going down here, National Grid does, at Solomon Jacobs Park. And we're going to have a new Harbor Master Marina in here next year, as well as the shoreside pump-out facility. So after the dredging is complete, we're going to be able to have boats come right into our area and conduct a shoreside pump-out. So it's a good program, keeps the waters clean, keeps the shellfish clean, you know, and overall keeps the harbor a lot cleaner. So,
well, I know. As a kid, we used to dive off of Beacon Marine and swim over to Rocky Neck, and it was anything but clean then. So it's a lot better now. But you can actually catch
really,
fish out of there.
Really is. It absolutely is. You know, you can go pretty much anywhere in Gloucester and have 10, 12, 15 feet of visibility in some places now.
Yeah.
You know, it was never like that. So, you know, cleanliness of the harbor is huge. It's huge for me. It's huge for the Coast Guard. It's huge for the state. You know, it's a big deal now. EPA regulations have really gotten extremely strict into what, you know, can go in and out of the harbor, even if you're pumping, you know, some places that are even taking salt water to pump and feed live lobster tanks onshore have to filter that water before it goes back out into the harbor. So, you know, regulations have gotten pretty tough, and as a result, you know, we have a lot cleaner water. So it's kind of a win-win.
Great. I want to thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule, and Captain, and being on Trending Now with Josh Arnold. Wishing you the very best of luck as you continue in your position.
All right. Appreciate it, sir. Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Isn't it amazing when you watch something on television and two people from different backgrounds or different ideals or ideas see two completely different things?
Well, yeah, I'm always remember the when President Kennedy sent two people to Vietnam to give them a report. They came back and they gave two completely different reports, and he looked and he says, "Did you guys go to the same country?" Everybody sees things different.
Yep. And that's why we do it. All right. What you got down in the pipeline?
Bunch of people in different stages. Nothing I can report on yet, but we will have some more people talking about, from both sides of the both parties talking about the presidential election after the next debate, as well as people up and down the North Shore.
Okay. Football coming up tonight on MSO News Sports. Don't forget on Channel A, it is Danvers Atlin Classical. That is our video, live streaming video game tonight with Bill Newell and Tim Kearns. And on Channel B tonight, it is Lynn English at Peabody High School. Paul Ingram and I will be there. And, of course, tomorrow, big game in Beverly. Danvers, did I say Danvers? It's Marblehead at Lynn Classical tonight. Danvers at Beverly tomorrow. Marblehead at Lynn Classical tonight. And Danvers at Beverly tomorrow. That game is at 2:30. But all of that is previewed right here on MSO News Sports with Bill Newell's football preview show. Just take a look at it. It's right here on the main page of the website right now. And all kinds of interviews and information as to what's going on this weekend. That'll do it for Josh Arnold, our producer and engineer, Bill Proposky. I'm Rick Moore. Have a great weekend.